Hi, everyone. Welcome to News and Brew Sports Biz, our podcast series that advocates for the financial voices in college athletics and features new developments impacting the business of college sports. I'm Katie Davis.
And I'm Shane Metzler. Today, we'll be covering a topic that I'm very interested in, sports betting. Joining us today is Clint Punkabrow, Managing Director of Enterprise Risk Management at the NCAA. Welcome, Clint.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Thanks for joining us, Clint. We wanted to start by having you provide some background on your role in enterprise risk management at the NCAA and how that ties in with your role overseeing the NCAA's sports wagering initiatives.
Yeah, thanks. I may just walk through kind of the background of my career a bit, if that's okay. And I think that'll lead to where I'm at today. So I graduated in 03 as a business management graduate. And right around that time, you all may recall, there was some challenges with WorldCom and Enron and Arthur Anderson and some nefarious activity that was happening within that within those organizations. And so around that time, there was the Sarbanes-Oxley Act that was passed that really talked about with public companies strengthening their internal controls. So that kind of led me down the path coming out of college of pursuing more of an audit background. So I worked with Walmart for 4 years in their kind of corporate audit department and managed inventory audits and things like that. And then left there, went to a large CPA firm and worked in their risk consulting group for a number of years, had a variety of different clients that I helped with all types of risk from complying with Sarbanes-Oxley to managing capital projects and financial controls around those. But I was headquartered here in Indianapolis, and we landed a project with the NCAA working with their accounting department to improve financial controls. And I was actually working on another client at the time, but I remember telling the partner in charge, like, I gotta get on this client with the NCAA and at least help a little bit. So I was able to come over here and help on that project. And then as luck would have it, shortly thereafter, they were actually, the NCAA was looking at building their first ever internal audit function. So stepped into that role, did that responsibility a number of years, building out, a robust internal audit function that's consistent with the professional standards. And around that time, this was about a decade ago, there was a couple enforcement cases that ended up going awry. And really, there was kind of a cry within our membership to strengthen the quality control processes in place for the enforcement department to make sure that we were consistent and among cases and that we were in compliance with our different bylaws and so forth that we have to follow as we conduct investigations. So, you know, I thought it might be one of those areas where there were some transferable skills from kind of more of a traditional audit process to doing that quality control work. So I went over to the enforcement staff, certainly one of the most enriching experiences within my career, just learned so much, such fascinating work, often misunderstood, certainly by the public and even sometimes by the membership, but just encountered working there, 60 incredibly hardworking, dedicated individuals. So I started out by building the quality control function and then went on to lead a lot more just operational work. I managed our budget. I managed different systems and technology, improved our data reporting, did a lot of process improvement work, things like that. So just kind of a hodgepodge of different business related functions. I had kind of built up that function to where I felt like, okay, we're kind of clicking on all cylinders now, and it may be time for me to kind of step on and look for a new challenge, a new opportunity. So around that time, our managing director of enterprise risk management was leaving the organization. So our CFO reached out and kind of tapped me and said, hey, do you want to step into this role? So I've been now doing this for another couple years here and really excited for the different opportunities that it presents. It's you know, kind of ERM, enterprise risk management in a nutshell. So I oversee our internal audit function. And there's a lot of different types of audits that we do there, from audits of our championship host to different third-party vendors that we work with, to different process improvement exercises. So actually working with your all's team right now on a really helpful project to look at our ticketing processes and improve our processes and our controls in that space. So we do a lot of partnering with different third-party subject matter experts. Oversaw our gender equity assessment work the last couple of years to make sure that we are making enhancements to our student athlete experience from that perspective. So just a wide portfolio of different projects that I oversee from an audit perspective. I oversee our information and cybersecurity related work. And then there was, as I was transitioning into the role, I'll never forget our CFO at the time saying, and there's really kind of this little small thing that, you know, you're going to have some focus on, and it's helping leading some of our work from a sports wagering standpoint within the organization. And I thought to myself at the time, you know, I know this is just really starting to take off, and a lot of states were just starting to really legalize and get operational at this point. So, you know, I knew it would be an incredible challenge, but also an incredible opportunity just to lead in this space. So I'd say it's kind of under that enterprise risk management umbrella that I help oversee a lot of our sports wagering integrity work. I've kind of had this mantra within this role to just go where the need is. And this is a space where, you know, it's one of those that it impacts almost everything that we do as an organization, from our Sports Science Institute to our championship space to our regulatory work to legal and so on and so forth. But when I stepped in, there really wasn't kind of a clear owner of this work. So now I've really tried to take on that responsibility of leading in this space. There's another colleague of mine from the enforcement staff that I work really closely on this, but it's been a really challenging experience, but really rewarding at the same time.
Yeah, Clint, I'm sure. And, you know, it's funny you mentioned when you first started that initiative that, you know, they mentioned it was just a little piece that you were doing on the side. And, you know, of course, now there's more than 30 states where sports betting is legal. And with that number continuing to rise, and, you know, as sports wagering has just really become much more kind of mainstream and in the media across the country, you know, what impact, I guess, have you seen throughout this kind of rise in popularity, and what, you know, other impacts do you expect to see for, you know, your member institutions as well as their respective student athletes?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. So just to kind of take stock of where we're at right now. So to your point, there's 38 states that have now legalized sports betting, plus the District of Columbia. There's 35 states where it's now operational. So we actually have live sports betting within those states. So it really, just considering in 2018 is when the Supreme Court repealed PASPA. And at that time, there was just one state, Nevada, that had legalized sports betting, to 38 now in just 5 short years. It's just been a massive explosion. So I think in terms of the impacts, I tend to work on some of the kind of risk mitigation, harm prevention work. So I probably lean towards some of the negative impacts that we've seen from sports wagering, but I will cover just some of the positive impacts from my perspective. I think first off, it does create exposure within our championship events, within our NCAA competitions that happen throughout all of our member institutions and conferences. I think there are a lot of people that are enjoying now engaging in sports betting, and they want to consume new content. And so that's probably brought some folks to our NCAA competitions that are there kind of just to engage in it from a sports betting standpoint. And so I do think there's some opportunities there to just engage with fans. It's really amazing to me. We do work, I'll talk about it probably a little bit later, but with a company that monitors the betting markets and the lines and things like that. And I'm always stunned that there's a lot of international interest in folks that are like in Europe, for example. They're big volleyball fans, and you know, there's not a whole lot of professional and collegiate volleyball opportunities over there. So there's a lot of Europeans that are betting and like to tune in and watch men's and women's volleyball within the NCAA space. We see Russian markets around, you know, women's ice hockey and some different sports like that. So not only domestically, but internationally, it does create a lot of visibility into our different NCAA sporting contests, which then I think, you know, makes our assets more valuable from to the extent you have more people tuning in. I think there's more value from a media rights perspective and certainly other commercial perspective that may be out there. But what I've really seen is that there are a lot of positives within a regulated market now versus kind of the black market, offshore, unregulated markets that were happening before 2018. Sports betting is one of the most regulated marketplaces that there are. So there's a lot of safeguards and mechanisms in place that do help create transparency. And it's kind of that old adage of, you know, sunshine's the greatest disinfectant. Like there's just a lot more transparency built into this marketplace now that I think protects our competition, protects consumers, et cetera. So that's on the positive side. You know, certainly on the, there's been some challenging impacts to it as well. So we kind of look at those challenges in two different lenses. One being kind of challenges to the integrity of our competitions. So things like potential match fixing that could happen, point shaving. We've seen some situations already of insider information being shared by you know, folks in college athletics with bettors, and certainly that threatens the integrity of our competition. And then, you know, I think there's just sort of this allure almost for student athletes and others that, you know, I could get in there and bet on myself now that there's, you know, prop markets being offered and stuff, where it's almost like playing yourself in the video game. Like, I could get in and bet on myself or bet on my team. And so all of those sort of circumstances are certainly challenging from a integrity of competition perspective. But then the one that tends to keep me up more at night is really the threats to the health and safety of our student athletes. And kind of two different buckets within there. One is just the dangers of problem gambling or potential gambling disorders or addiction. So, you know, right around 2.5% of the population suffer from gambling addiction, but there's a lot of different data out there that points to, you know, college age students being more problematic from a gambling standpoint. And then really student athletes being even more so problematic from a gambling standpoint compared to their college student peers. Because you look at things like, it's kind of a paradox. A lot of the things that makes student athletes great manifest as vulnerabilities from a problem gambling standpoint. So that competitive fire that they have, you know, that's great for being a student athlete, but you know, it may cause you, if you start to engage in gambling, to kind of chase those losses or say, I hate to lose, and now I want to keep doing this so I could try to win. A lot of times that specialized knowledge that they have too, that may be a danger point where it's like, okay, I understand this sport really well, so it probably makes it more likely that I'll win compared to other folks that don't know it as well. So just some of those drivers within the student athlete kind of mental makeup, if you will, is really concerning from a problem gambling standpoint. But also we've seen this unfortunate phenomenon over the last couple of years as well of just social media abuse that happens, that I think that's a tale as old as time of just, you know, opposite rival fan bases reaching out and maybe harassing student athletes or coaches. But, you know, this new marketplace now around sports betting, there's really a lot of challenges that come out of hey, I lost $1,000 bet and now I want to blame somebody for it. So I'm going to reach out to student athletes, reach out to coaches, and harass them on social media. We've seen in the pro leagues, at least, some folks that are in venue doing that harassment of athletes as well. So certainly creates some challenges from that perspective as well. And I'll talk soon about some of the things that we're doing in all of those regards.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, those are all really important things to be thinking about. And, you know, it's interesting, Clint, that, you know, you started in business and kind of this auditing compliance world and probably never imagined that you would be in this exciting college sports space that so few of us that are, you know, in this auditor accountant type world get to be part of. But our audience is that side. So they are the financial side, more focused on that and understand this perspective. You know, as it relates to the business officers at your member institutions, they're really interested probably in hearing like what kind of revenue generation opportunities there could be as it relates to sports wagering. I read a recent article that stated that sports betting revenue is projected to grow from $7.3 billion in 2022 to $16.3 billion in 2026, and then up to $23.2 billion by 2030 because of this continued increase in popularity. And they're anticipating that the large states of Florida, California, and Texas, which currently aren't operating with betting, could legalize and start operating it over that time period. And given that sports books are heavily investing in marketing to achieve this kind of growth, it seems like sponsorships would be an opportunity for leagues to generate revenue and engage fans. The majority of the professional sports leagues are already partnering with sports books or other wagering platforms and sponsorship deals. So is this a route that you foresee the NCAA exploring? So for example, an official sports book partner for March Madness, or if not, are there other revenue generation strategies that you've kind of discussed related to sports wagering?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it probably wouldn't be a discussion with a risk management audit type if I didn't have a disclaimer in here somewhere that, that, you know, these are really my personal viewpoints and opinions, and certainly don't purport to represent the entire NCAA, because I think this is a really kind of polarizing topic and one that there's a lot of debate and discussion around the best place to be from a college athletic standpoint and our mission within higher education. I think one thing, Katie, to understand when you do see those reports around revenue, this is something as kind of a somebody with a finance and audit background that I didn't fully understand initially, is that when the sports books report revenue, it's essentially their take. It's what they've won from these betting markets. And so it's really the total amount wagered minus the total amount that they had to pay out. So ultimately just what's left for them is what they claim as revenue. So, you know, one of the stats that I tend to follow more is just what is the handle from a legalized sports betting standpoint. And the AGA just recently, the American Gaming Association, just put out some research that said in 2023, it's going to be the first time that we'll eclipse $100 billion just within the United States of sports betting related wagers. And really, when you look globally, it's like a $1 trillion marketplace, which I think is like the GDP of the Netherlands. So it's just, you know, a massive marketplace that's growing, certainly here domestically, but globally. So, when I think about some of the revenue opportunities, and I'll try to, you know, talk at the national level within the national office and how we kind of view the world, but then some of the opportunities maybe at a campus or conference level as well. So there's kind of different buckets of revenue, and they're all thorny in nature, but I'll start with maybe the least thorniest and work to the most. So I think when it, you know, on that least thorniest side, there are opportunities for official data deals. And we've already seen a couple conferences, as well as the bowls that have entered into those deals, which is basically a way to say, hey, a lot of these betting markets, these operators, they're all powered off of data, real-time, high-quality, low-latency data that sportsbooks could use to power all the different markets that they're offering. A lot of where sportsbooks currently get their data is through what I would describe as unofficial channels. So picture people, kind of term I use is court siding, where there's just people sitting in venues watching games. You know, you could hire high schoolers to do this that are just in there kind of typing in all the different stats and play-by-play stuff that's happening within those games. So you could certainly see that there's almost a consumer protection element to that. Like, how are we verifying the accuracy of that data? If it's off, it could certainly disrupt a betting market that's being offered, where conferences and institutions and us at the NCAA, there's really robust data collection processes and systems in place, where there are opportunities there to do official data deals where you'd use intermediary companies like a Genius Sports or a Sport Radar to collect that data and ultimately sell that on to sports books. So I think that's one revenue opportunity that in my estimation actually helps create higher integrity within the sports betting space. I do think it's a challenge where the public at large doesn't really understand it. So they still view it as, you know, you're just making money off of sports betting. So, you know, it requires some PR type work around that type of thing. We don't currently do that at the NCAA, but there are, as I mentioned, a couple conferences that already have struck these deals. And I could certainly see a lot more conferences in the future that would have official data deals. So then there's the sponsorship side, as you mentioned. And there have been, by my count, I think 5 institutions that have had sponsorship deals with your Caesars of the world or your PointsBet, who's now part of Bet Fanatics. And, you know, those didn't go well. I think there was a lot of scrutiny from the public around what those were. There was some scrutiny from politicians around, you know, why are you doing this on a college campus where, you know, majority of your population probably can't even sports bet in states where it's 21 plus and you have a lot of 18 to 20 year olds on campus. And so, you know, in our world, in kind of the audit profession, I look at it as internal controls. Like if you could have those sponsorship opportunities, but have a lot of safeguards, have a lot of internal controls around, you know, where's there going to be signage for this? Is it going to be things that, you know, a majority of the people are 21 plus that are going to see this signage? Or are we going to have a lot of, you know, folks under the age of 21 that are going to consume this sponsorship opportunity that we're considering? There was some list of promotional activities that went out to, you know, large student populations where a lot of them weren't even of age to bet yet. So another one of those areas, like what internal controls were there around some of these marketing promotions that were happening and making sure that those were only of age people that were receiving those. So the AGA, actually, who I referenced earlier, they made an update to their marketing code. So they're a trade organization of the sports books, the regulated sports books, essentially. Not every sports book rolls up under the AGA, but most of them do, where they really said, you know, we got to be really careful with how we're doing these sponsorship opportunities on college campuses. They also discouraged any sort of NIL deals between sports books and student athletes specifically. So I think between that update and a lot of the pressure that came from media reports and politicians and so forth, there's been kind of a chilling effect where I don't think we'll see a whole lot of institutions rushing to enter these sponsorship deals with sports books. But I could certainly see a place down the road when we kind of understand this market better, understand those safeguards and controls to have in place where you could start to pursue some sponsorship opportunities like that. And then the last bucket, I would say, is sort of two things, media rights as well as advertising. Again, us at the national level, there's currently a prohibition on any sort of advertising around gambling or sports betting that would happen on any NCAA championships. Again, just me talking, I don't see us changing that anytime in the near future, nor would I encourage kind of conferences and institutions to change, just because you know, it can be certainly problematic where it looks like you're essentially endorsing that activity. You know, that as there's less of maybe a stigma around this, that could certainly change down the road. But I do think from a media rights standpoint, we've seen now that consumer behaviors are changing for just how individuals want to consume sports. I have an 11 and 13 year old. Like, all they want to do is just sit on their phone and kind of watch sports that way, instead of kind of sitting with dad on the couch and watching it on the big screen. So, you know, I think down the road, you'll see potential opportunities where there's folks like the DraftKings and FanDuels of the world that they actually want to buy, you know, one competition a week, let's say, like in the MLB, for example. They did a thing this year where Apple TV Friday nights, there was a game that was streamed. So I could see some opportunities for betting companies wanting to actually buy limited competitions and stream those on their platforms. I mean, picture a thing when you're watching a basketball game on an app on your phone, and you could actually click on the players in real time and make what they call micro bets of those individuals, who's going to hit the next three pointer, who's going to hit the next layup, things like that. You know, I certainly think that's a really potentially engaging opportunity that I think that's going to be the next generation of consumers of sports. So folks are going to really have to consider that as they're pursuing those different media right deals.
Yeah, well, you know, what's interesting is I wonder, too, if it could be like geographically, you know, something like that, geographically kind of bound, so that you can only stream it if you're located like within a certain proximity of their football stadium or mm-hmm. their basketball arena, so that it encourages fans to come watch live, buy tickets, but then you can also engage through technology, which is what's becoming more important for the next generation too.
Yep.
Yeah, and Clint, it's you know, what you were mentioning about both conferences and the NCAA kind of shying away from the, you know, the advertising deals with sports books does, you know, it makes so much sense, because even the, you know, the NFL, who, you know, they're engaging with, you know, typically in an older audience, and also, you know, all of their players are typically, you know, adults, and, you know, would yep. have that, you know, ability to sports bet if they want to. Even they came under scrutiny when they announced, you know, the deal with, I guess, FanDuel or DraftKings sportsbooks mm-hmm. a few years ago, you know, where people were kind of, you know, feeling like they were a bit hypocritical for coming down, bashing players, and, you know, getting big, handing down big suspensions for, players betting, where, you know, they're taking, you know, you can't watch an NFL game without every single commercial break saying one or two yep. different ads for a sports book. So, you know, I totally understand that, and kind of the scrutiny that would entail with allowing that advertising. But shifting a little bit more to the compliance side of things. So how is your committee, you know, utilizing different educational programs, as well as, you know, just active monitoring to help with just enforcing integrity and fair play, and just monitoring that as, you know, it's becoming a higher risk with sports wagering?
Yeah, that's a great question. And this is definitely more in my wheelhouse of a lot of the work that I oversee. And, you know, you had referenced a committee. This is kind of one of those areas that one of the rare areas within the NCAA structure where there really isn't a committee that, you know, directly oversees this work. We just had a lot of different governance meetings the last couple of weeks. So certainly we've tried to do a good job engaging on all three division levels, the board of directors, the different councils that are in place, our board of governors, but there's really not a direct committee that oversees it. So it's really a lot of just work cross-functionally that happens within the NCAA national office. But our primary focus first has been around education and awareness, sort of that prevention side. We'd much rather prevent bad outcomes from happening than trying to deal and react to them after the fact. So we've put a lot of work into the educational side. We've partnered now for a number of years with a company called Epic Risk Management. They're a company based out of Europe. They specialized in what's called lived experience education around the topic of problem gambling. So picture somebody who's an athlete. A lot of their facilitators are former student athletes, and they're talking about their story of their athletic career, starting to engage in gambling, and then some really negative impacts and outcomes that that had on their career, their relationships, their goals, et cetera. And then ultimately their rehabilitation. So free of charge, we have a deal with them to go out and provide education to 150 member institutions per year. So that covers about 20,000 student athletes. Most of their programming is directly focused on the student athlete population, but they also do what's called sort of a train the trainer type program where they're educating coaches and administrators, those folks closest to student athletes, to here's the dangers on how you could potentially spot a student athlete who may have a gambling problem. Because, you know, it's not like drugs or alcohol where there's physical signs where you could see if somebody's struggling. This is, you know, folks that are just looking at their apps, and that's, you know, pretty much the whole 18 to 22 demographic right now. So we do a lot of work with Epic around the in-person education that happens. But we know we have a very large constituency group where you have 500,000 student athletes, 19,000 teams that we have across 23 sports, three divisions. And so we're not going to be able to have Epic that goes out to every single campus throughout the course of every year to deliver in-person education. So actually just a couple weeks ago, we rolled out an e-learning module as well on sports wagering. So it has Zaire Franklin, who's a Colts linebacker, former Syracuse student athlete who starts the education. And then there's two former student athletes, one that's a women's basketball player and another one that was a football student athlete in Division II, that kind of walk through the topics that we've been talking about: problem gambling, the importance of integrity, the NCAA rules around sports wagering. And then they close by talking about social media abuse and how student athletes might handle that. So I'm really proud of that e-learning so far. It's available on our website. It's free of charge. It's about 15 minutes long. Anybody could see it. We're also integrating it into our eligibility center processes because we know a lot of our prospective student athletes are starting to engage in sports betting even at the high school age. So we want to get them this information as they're starting to kind of matriculate to campus and go through those procedures. So again, a lot of work on the educational side. There's a lot of different monitoring efforts that we have put in place as well. So we work with a large global data company that does integrity service monitoring, where they look at every single college game where there's a betting market around those. And there's over 13,000 of those per year. And they're looking for suspicious betting activity. You know, have the lines really moved dramatically in a particular contest, and there's not a valid explanation behind that? They do that both in what's called the pregame markets, so all the things leading up to the game, as well as the live in-game markets that are happening. So certainly, you know, there's a lot of interesting alerts and things that they flag through that process. I am happy to report it's really far less than 1% of those contests where there is any sort of suspicious betting activity. So that's a sign that I do think there's there's high integrity around the competitions that we have, but it's good to have that as a safeguard in place that if there really was some suspicious betting activity, we would be alerted to it through that process. We also work really closely. There's some licensed independent integrity monitors that work closely with the gaming commissions in each state, as well as the sports books, that if because sports books don't want to offer, corrupt markets either. That's bad for business.
Right.
So there's a lot of different monitoring work that they do. So if a sports book were to identify a suspicious bet, they would tell these independent integrity monitors, who their primary purpose then is to tell all of the other regulated sports books within that marketplace to help protect the books as well as the consumers from a betting market that may have some integrity concerns, but they're also required to report those to us as the national governing body. So we've developed really good relationships with those organizations to work through issues as they come up. We actually have really good relations with the regulated sports books. So, about 90% of the regulated market goes through five books, and that's DraftKings, FanDuel, BetMGM, BetFanatics, and Caesars. And so we've done a lot of outreach with them just so that as issues do come up, they know who to reach out to and we could work through those situations collaboratively. We know with officials that that's certainly a risky area as well. So we do 19,000 background checks per year of our championship officials that we use, and we make that information available to our conferences as well. And then just this year on the social media abuse piece, we're working with a company now to monitor different social media platforms and identify those areas of abuse directed at our student athletes, our coaches, our officials, and the like, and actually going to report those on to law enforcement if there's some sort of threat to life situation, or at minimum get those to the social media companies if it's really malicious content directed towards those championship participants. So really excited about that effort that we're doing. And then, you had mentioned research. So we have a world-class, really robust research function at the national office, and we've worked really closely with them in this space. Certainly our new president, Charlie Baker, since he's come on in spring timeframe of this year, he's been really keenly focused on the dangers of sports wagering as a top priority for him. So right when he started, he did a market research study that focused on 18 to 22 year olds generally, so not specifically student athletes, but their habits as it relates to sports betting. And it found like nearly two-thirds of kids on campus are engaging in sports betting. So just a huge population of college age students that are betting on sports. But we've done surveys with our compliance officers to hear what they're saying. And we also have a massive study that we do once every 4 years that surveys over 20,000 student athletes to talk about their behaviors and attitudes as it relates to sports betting. Because of COVID, that got canceled in 2020. So we haven't done one since 2016. So it's going to be really interesting to see now with the explosion of sports betting, with it being legalized throughout the states, the impact that has on that data. That study is referenced around the world because there's not a whole lot of studies that focus around student athletes generally, and their views and attitudes as it relates to sports betting.
Yeah, that's all really interesting. And just, I think as you start to see more of that data and what kind of impact that will have on the monitoring and then, your enforcement roles. And we've seen numerous instances in the past year, both in pro sports and college, where athletes face disciplinary action for sports wagering. And just in the last month, the NFL completely overhauled their personal conduct policy as it relates to gambling. Has the NCAA considered undertaking any similar measures?
Yeah, we have. And I'll differentiate just a little bit between rules and then penalties. So from a penalties standpoint, There's two different processes that we have. One is the enforcement process that ultimately goes to the Committee on Infractions. And that focuses on the adults, if you will, coaches, folks like that, who may be engaging in, you know, anything that's a violation of NCAA bylaws, but we have a bylaw around sports wagering specifically. And then a separate process that student athletes go through called the student athlete reinstatement process. There's a different committee that ultimately decides those cases throughout the three different divisions that we have. So we've seen within our Division One and Division Three, I'd say more of kind of a less punitive approach and more rehabilitative, where they're understanding, you know, we're going to have a lot of student athletes because of the marketing, the advertising, it's all around them with the student population that are engaging in sports betting. Let's take a look at those and kind of put them into two different categories. If they're things that truly threaten the integrity of competition, like sharing insider information, like match fixing, like betting on your own competitions, then we probably need to hold the line there and have some pretty significant penalties around that activity. But if it's a little bit more innocuous than that, maybe they're engaging in just betting on pro sports, NFL, NBA, et cetera. Let's really start with education and awareness and mental health services and things like that that may be available to them. So there's been a lot of updates within those two divisions. Division two is going to update or is going to review their guidelines in the near future and potentially may make similar updates. But then there's the rule piece, which is a little bit of a tougher nut to crack, if you will, where our rule right now is essentially, there used to be the tagline, don't bet on it, but student athletes to coaches, to us at the national office, to anybody with athletics responsibilities, you cannot bet on any sport at any level in which the NCAA has a championship. So a Division One track and field student athlete can't bet on the World Series that's happening right now because we offer a baseball championship. So it's a really restrictive rule, but it's a rule that is consistent and spans across all three of the NCAA divisions. And so it really would take sort of the will of the membership throughout those three different divisions to re-examine that. So to answer your question, we have made some tweaks from a penalty standpoint, but I do think it's a much broader conversation from a rule standpoint and just a trickier one, because I think we could all agree, like, okay, who cares if a, you know, student athlete bets $5 on a NFL game and they're a, you know, a rower or something like that. But there is this, I think, this kind of gateway impact that could happen where, okay, now you're in the betting app. The betting app, I mean, sports books make money for a reason. Like, they know who you are. They know your preferences. You're probably going to start seeing a lot of advertising and marketing related to what you're interested in. So those specific sports you're in, those specific schools that you're at. And so it does create, like, I heard somebody recently analogize it to, you know, you go to the Mexican restaurant and they bring out the fajita tray and it's sizzling and smells amazing. What do they tell you? They say, okay, you can't touch that. It's hot, right? And then, like, what do like half of us do? We end up just touching the thing because we're interested in it. So, you know, it creates a really tough spot, I think, if we were to liberalize that, where, you know, you could potentially walk some folks in our membership into some really bad outcomes with that.
Yeah, and that's totally understandable. And, you know, what works or doesn't work today may look very different 10 years from now.
Yep.
Just like, you know, beer advertising, and now there are beers, you know, made just for sports, for university athletic departments to represent them. And so that's my segue into talking about the brews of the month. So Clint, we've shared with you before, but we like to, as we travel to different universities that we work with or to the NCAA, we'd like to visit the local craft brewery while we're there and sample new things. And so I'll start with you. Is there anything particular that you've been enjoying lately?
Yeah, well, it is Halloween as we are engaging in this podcast. So we do have a Halloween tradition where the neighbors like to get together as the kids are going around trick-or-treating and maybe engage in a adult beverage or two. So may very well have one tonight. But I tend to like, you know, in the summer months, a lot of the ales and IPAs and some of those. And even I've gotten into some of the ciders and things like that over the last couple of years. But I'd say once it starts getting to colder weather here in Indiana, it's where my focus kind of turns to, you know, some of the porters and stouts and some of the darker beers. But particularly around Halloween, there's a brewery right across the street from my house called Big Woods Brewing. And they have a pumpkin ale actually called Put a Fork in It. It's about 6.5%, 20 IBU. So it's not overly strong, but they actually do even a little like cinnamon rim on it. And it just hits the spot. I don't know what it is about it, but it's really good on a cold Halloween night. So I think I'm going to get some of that on my way home. And I'm not, you know, there's pumpkin spice everything right now. And I'm not typically your pumpkin spice guy, but there's something about that pumpkin ale that really hits the spot.
Yeah, it sounds good. I'm not a pumpkin spice person either, but some of the pumpkin beers I do like. Yeah. Shane, what about you?
Yeah, so, you know, actually, as Katie had mentioned, you know, we like to try the local breweries when we're going around. So just last month when we were there visiting you all, we stopped by Gugman House Brewery. And one of the beers that we had there was Hop Traveler, which is it's a New England hazy double IPA. And it was phenomenal. It was a really delicious beer.
Yeah, and so we all got flights so that we can sample as many as possible. And I tried one of the sours because I keep hearing sours here on the podcast from guests and elsewhere. And so I'm trying to start to like them. And I always ask the question of, is it really sour? And sometimes they're like, yeah, it's a sour. Then I'm like, no, I don't want it. But if they tell me it's not too bad, I'll try it. So they actually said that. So one I tried was called Into the Wild. It's their Into the Wild series, I guess, but it was a pineapple sour. It was actually really good. But I probably couldn't drink more than like the small glass in the flight before it just gets to be too sweet and too much for me. So Clint, next time we are in Indianapolis, we'll have to get together at Gugman House or at your favorite brewery too.
Sounds great.
But Clint, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah. Enjoy the trick or treating tonight.
Yeah. It's great to be on and would just encourage your folks listening to this. If they ever want to reach out with questions, my number is 317-966-6484. My email's changebrauck@nca.org. We're always happy to answer questions or hear feedback that our member institutions have. So thanks so much for having me on.
Yeah, thank you, Clint. And there you have it. Our first guest that has given out phone number and email address. And that's really good information because
hope I don't regret it.
This is important. So if there are questions, you know, Clint is a great guy. We highly recommend that you reach out. But thank you all for tuning in. Cheers.
Cheers. Yep. Thanks, Clint.
Cheers.
To learn more about the James Moore & Company Collegiate Athletics and Higher Education segments, go to jmco.com. And don't forget to sign up for Insights to get our latest industry updates, news, and events delivered straight to your inbox. You can also follow us on Twitter at @JMCOHigherEd and on LinkedIn for the latest news as the landscape of collegiate athletics and higher education is continually evolving.